You are listening to National Security Law Today.
Welcome to National Security Law Today, the podcast of the ABA's Standing Committee on Law and National Security. I'm Elisa Poteet. I'm always here in my individual capacity. We're beginning our series on the future of our defense and national security workforce, and we're going to start with some of the pressing concerns now facing young men. This is not to exclude a later discussion about some of the concerns facing young women, but some of the issues with young men right now are different. And I think it's important to talk about those things because the 14 to 16-year-olds of today are going to be the pilots, engineers, lawyers, and developers of tomorrow. So are we actually helping them get there, or is the use of devices changing their trajectory in a way that could ultimately harm our ability to protect the United States, diminish our overall intellectual functioning, and move from a country of supreme excellence to something else, which is more subordination to technology? Social scientist Jonathan Haidt at the NYU Stern School of Business has written a book called The Anxious Generation, in which he provides evidence and data that constant access to devices is producing a generation of depressed, socially isolated, anxious, and generally less interested in society young people. What has happened is when they look at social media, it produces a small dopamine hit in their brains. You might remember Brave New World or any of the other sort of future-leaning books, science fiction, where people had become addicted to things like Soma. But these dopamine hits have been found to be addicted, and many young people are now having to be treated for addiction to social media. Now, Richard Reeves, who's a social scientist at the Brookings Institute, or formerly, he's now running his own org, but he is the author of an important book called Of Boys and Men, Why the Modern Male is Struggling, Why It Matters, and What to Do About It. And Reeves' book provides hard data on how boys are falling behind in school and struggling increasingly with loneliness and depression and are essentially opting out of the social contract. Even more recent research shows that the brains of college students who spend more than 2 hours a day on social media, which apparently is most of them now, they're showing in the areas where long-term attention is needed, focus and critical thinking, those areas of the brain are showing diminished functioning. So the brain chemistry of young people is actually changing. Now, worse, and part of this, and perhaps a symptom of this, many young men are falling victim to something known as sextortion. And an alarming number of teenage boys have fallen victim in the United States. Now, there are a few people out there who are trying to study and quantify this problem and raise public awareness about it. And one of them is my guest tonight. Paul, I'm going to get your name exactly right. Is it Raphael?
Raphael.
Yes. Okay. He is a cyber threat analyst, formerly the senior intelligence analyst at the Network Contagion Research Institute. He's one of the authors of A Digital Pandemic, Uncovering the Role of Yahoo Boys in the Surge of Social Media-Enabled Financial Sextortion Targeting Minors. It's a lot of words, but Paul, thanks for coming in. We're really glad you did.
Thank you for having me.
All right. How did you first hear or learn about the pattern of sextortion in young men, since a lot of our listeners may never have heard of it?
I had never heard of this term either up until about 2 years ago, when a friend of mine came to me with an embarrassing problem. He was approached by someone online pretending to be a girl his age. She sent him a photo, an intimate photo, and asked him to return one. As soon as he did, that's when the blackmail began. This is a scam. It's a scam that involves sexual coercion, harassment, cyber stalking, threatening. We'll certainly get into more details about what sextortion actually is. But once I heard about it from a friend, and yeah, I just wanted to help. From there, I started to see what was happening and putting pieces together and connecting patterns that a lot of these activities, a lot of these criminal acts were actually connected back to a single organized crime group operating out of West Africa.
So you've explained just sort of in general terms what sextortion is. Are we finding particular platforms on which young men are approached? How are they being contacted? Is it Snap? Is it Insta? Where are they being targeted?
Yeah, Instagram and Snapchat are the top two apps where financial sextortion is targeting minors by far. And there's reason for that. And it's the particular design of these apps and certain privacy settings that make them more amenable to the sextortion criminals who use certain things like Snapchat's disappearing photos feature to give victims a false sense of security that their pictures are going to disappear.
Let's quantify this problem because otherwise it just sounds like a story, right? That maybe involves a few people. It's not just a story that involves a few people. Right now, what does the data show about, like, out of 100 or out of 10 young men, how many of them have self-reported or have been found to be victims of this kind of sextortion?
Among young people right now, the latest data from Snapchat themselves show that 51% of young people have been targeted by sextortion, and 23% of young people report being victimized by sextortion. This is a huge increase from where this data was just a couple of years ago, less than 5% of the population reporting being victimized.
So, roughly a quarter of the people are paying these fraudsters operating out of, I imagine it's mostly Nigeria, is what I understand, correct?
That's where most of these are coming from.
Okay. What are the ages of these victims?
So, according to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, 90% of victims are boys aged 14 to 17. We're also seeing a large number of college-aged students as well.
You know, one of the issues with any sort of sexual crime is you mentioned the embarrassment factor. The data that we have right now, is that based on self-report? Do we know how Snap is collecting their data? How reliable is it? Is it possible this problem's far bigger?
It is quite possible it is bigger. Snapchat used an outside academic researcher to conduct their study, and they surveyed participants across six different countries. Additionally, we can look at data from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. A couple of years ago, back in 2021, there were only 139 reported cases of financial sextortion targeting minors here in the United States. By 2023, that number was over 26,000. And NCMEC is soon to announce that 2024 numbers exceeded 30,000 last year. So that's an 18,000% increase in the span of just 2 to 3 years.
That's a lot, but I still think that that sounds like we don't have a real handle on this. But I think the point that we were making earlier is that research is showing that people are retreating from in vivo, in-person engagement with their peers, and they're increasingly lonely. And perhaps they're doing things online, like trying to meet people online to quell some of that could be dealt with better by getting the heck off their phones and maybe having more in-person engagement. Let's talk a little bit about who the victims are. We talked about the age of the victims, but this has got a really dark side. So talk about, like, what are victims doing? They're being extorted, and what are they doing? Are they paying? And what happens when they can't?
Unfortunately, yeah, these extortionists have very dire, very urgent demands. You must pay me $500 right now, or else I'm going to leak your photos to everybody from your school, from your friends list, your family. And a lot of these kids and teens are scared into paying. But in other instances, this has resulted in tragic outcomes. We're aware of at least 46 teenagers who have died by suicide within the past several years, as a direct result while they were being blackmailed by these criminals.
I did see that there was a senator, I believe, a state senator from South Carolina, who caught my attention over the last week because I know he came to the Hill. And he talked about, and it sounded like, you know, high functioning family, everybody, there was a lot of love there, but his son was obviously lonely and isolated. And I know he was one of several parents who came to testify, I think, in whatever hearings they had on the Take It Down law.
Take it down,
Do you want
Act.
to talk a little bit about what that was supposed to do and whether that could have any efficacy here to protect kids?
Yeah, so right now we're seeing the Take It Down Act, which has passed the Senate and is now waiting for the House. This is the first federal act that would federally criminalize sextortion and financial sextortion, as well as deepfakes used in sextortion attempts as well. Very great that we're holding these criminals accountable, but it's to be seen if it will actually be effective. Of course, we know a lot of these criminals are overseas, and this, of course, relies on extradition and partnerships with law enforcement agencies globally.
Yeah, and I did see, I mean, I'm sure you've seen this too, pictures of the people behind this dancing and celebrating the amount of money that they're making off of these young men.
Well, what's absolutely crazy to me is that the criminals who are participating in sextortion are openly flaunting what they are doing because they think they will never get caught. They are showing off their riches, their new cars that they're purchasing. And of course, they're using this platform of theirs to recruit other scammers into this crime with them. Just last week, there was a TikTok video of one of these criminals who is a self-proclaimed blackmailer, and his video reached a million views. That was the first time we've ever seen anything like that. What's worse, if you go into the comments of this video, it is flooded, 20,000 comments of eager scammers wanting to get in on this to learn how to blackmail, learn how to do sextortion. So this crime is likely just exploding right now and is going to get worse.
Let's talk a little bit about the shame factor here and whether they would think they could ever be eligible for security clearances. What are you seeing in terms of the human devastation after this, the confidence level? You mentioned suicides that we can attribute at least 47. But if you're talking about that many people being targeted and a quarter of those polled saying that they actually paid out, and apparently they only paid out if they shared an intimate photo of themselves, and so they now know that that's out there. What are you kind of seeing or hearing is the long-term effect on these victims and how they see themselves?
First, from a national security perspective, we've just reduced the eligible population of people who are eligible to work for military and sensitive national security roles by 25%. And so we need to be thinking about how that's impacting the workforce moving forward. I certainly know as part of going through that clearance process, they ask you, have you ever been blackmailed? Or does any foreign national have blackmail material over you? Of course, that makes people ineligible for lots of critical positions. So we're reducing the workforce. And just in terms of these victims, the trauma and impact that it immediately has on them, more than half of victims, which was one of the surprising things to me. I thought the suicidal ideations were kind of a worst case scenario, but new research out of Florida indicates that more than half of victims report feeling suicidal after they've been a victim of sextortion.
Yeah, and even if this happened when they were young and, they report that to where whoever they're applying to work for, it also could be a deterrent. Like they could feel like they can't work for they can't bring their talents to a particular national security agency if they believe that the photos are still out there and available for access.
I've seen this for other careers too. They mentioned that they want to work in, some sort of public-facing role or sports or things like that. And their immediate concern is, how am I supposed to reactivate my social media accounts in order for me to have a career in that field if I know that those criminals are just going to be out there looking for me in the future?
Part of the research that is out there right now is showing that there is a loneliness epidemic that is striking boys in a particular way and making them, I think, more vulnerable to this sort of approach than they would be if they were out and engaging with peers in person. Let's just switch for a second and talk about policies. We talked a little bit about the Take It Down Act. Have you thought about other things other than just penalizing afterwards these crimes, if there's other things that can be done vis-a-vis legislation to protect teenagers right now or to avoid this kind of thing happening in the first place rather than trying to shore something up after the damage has been done?
Absolutely. There are probably two very big preventative things we can do on the policy and legislative side to prevent these crimes from even happening in the first place. The first one is, of course, education and awareness, mandating that teens be educated about this topic in some instances is, of course, one option. The other option is the social media platforms that this is happening on, having some sort of accountability or liability for when things go wrong and when illicit activity happens to minors on those platforms. The Kids Online Safety Act, for example, is one of those pieces of legislation that would create a duty of care for the social media platforms to consider how could their platform and products and services be abused by criminals as part of the design process to make it safer.
Well, right now that hasn't happened, right? We're still living under sort of the almost immunity that was conveyed by Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. Have you heard any platforms claiming that they're going to jigger the algorithm sufficiently to prevent this?
Some platforms have claimed that they are doing a lot. I certainly haven't seen the numbers go down in the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. Their tip line has not seen numbers go down either.
Okay, so whatever they're doing, it doesn't seem like it's working, and the problem sounds like it's metastasizing. You said there was something called the Online Kids Privacy. I think it's the Online Children's Privacy Act, whatever it's called. Tell us what you have noticed about that legislation and why you think it might be helpful.
The Kids Online Safety Act is really an update to what you mentioned of Section 230. Section 230 is essentially immunity for the social media platforms. They cannot be held liable in any way right now for any criminal activity that occurs on their platforms. But, with the Kids Online Safety Act, the idea is there that platforms, have to be able to take account of what's happening and prevent any foreseeable harms that may occur.
Is there anything else that you have noticed in Congress other than the hearings that we just talked about, where, bereaved parents are explaining what's happening and asking Congress to do something? Have you seen any other movement in the direction of stopping this, or is it ultimately going to come down to people deciding that it's time to put down their phones?
Aside from the two pieces of legislation that we've discussed, those are the two heavy hitters that I see right now. There have been other advancements, like getting funding for NCMEC, getting funding for the Internet Crimes Against Children task forces, which are all great wins, but nothing I'm seeing that has really shifted the tides as much as we need to right now.
Any other parting thoughts that you'd like to share with our listeners who tend to be inside the Beltway policy and lawyer types who might be in a position to work forward to try to do something about this? My first thought is I think communities need to rebuild and make more opportunities for people to be together who are teenagers in a relatively safe environment. I also think parents need to get serious about taking their kids' phones at night, and particularly when they're at home and they become acutely lonely. I don't think the parental controls on these phones work, and I think that's by design. The next buying cluster of people who would sustain these platforms by being available for targeted advertising is the very group that we're talking about. And I don't think they want to do anything to throttle the flow of posts that can reach them. I feel like these kids are so isolated, and the data shows that they are. You're not going to win through awareness. You're going to win by getting them off this dopamine feeding answer to loneliness that has prevented them from going out and engaging with their peers. I mean, they're dating less, they're engaging in less sexual activity, and maybe that's good, but there are all sorts of things that previous generations have done that they are no longer doing.
So my final thoughts are this. This is the largest blackmail operation in human history. This is not only a public safety emergency, but it's a national security emergency too. So of course we need to raise awareness. We need to talk about this in schools and at home. Parents, of course, take those phones during the evening. Phones don't need to be in the bedrooms at night. But also understand the risks of the apps that you and your kids are on. We think about Snapchat, and it's known for disappearing photos. And of course, that gives a false sense of security to teens and victims that their photos are not being saved by the people they're communicating with. And of course, Instagram, the moment that you accept a scammer's friend request on Instagram, your entire friends list is compromised. So just be very cautious of who you're accepting. Of course, those lists are the list that the blackmailers are using to threaten to send those photos to. And just, final thought, we need to do something to hold platforms accountable. Nothing is really going to change until there's a monetary or legal incentive for them to actually change.
I think those are all important thoughts, and I'm really glad we had this conversation tonight, Paul. We'll make sure to hyperlink to a PDF copy of the article that you have written on this topic. And I just want to say how much we value your work and your continued efforts to bring this to the surface.
Thank you so much. It was such a good chat, and thank you for elevating this to a group that I definitely would not have been able to access. So thank you guys for all the work you do.
All right. And thank you for listening to National Security Law Today. Remember to subscribe to our podcast. It does elevate it in the algorithm, believe it or not. Particularly if you're a national security lawyer, person in a policy position in Washington, you should discuss what we've talked about in this podcast, not just the sextortion, but the long-term impact on our country of the use of these devices and social media. We need to better understand it. We need to learn how to control it and not the other way around. It should not be controlling us. So remember, when you're having these conversations, there's a value in hearing other people's opinions and arguments. Of course, it makes you a better lawyer, a better researcher, a better policy analyst. It's important to listen to each other in a time when there's a lot of screaming. And by the way, guess where that screaming is coming from? Social media platforms. They are dividing us. Remember, a key feature of our national security is our unity in a country that is more diverse, not just in race, ethnicity, but in thought. And somehow we've held it together this long. Our producer and writer and host is me, Elisa Poteet. I'm always here in my individual capacity. Our editor and my co-producer is Frances Burkham. My other co-producer is the lovely sniffling tonight, showing up when she's sick, always powering on, no matter what, Holly McMahon. And of course, the angels behind this podcast are the people on the Standing Committee on Law and National Security. They're a bipartisan group. They're deep thinkers. Without them, this podcast would not be possible. We'll see you next time, and we'll talk more about the threats to our future workforce.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.